Get road trip ready with a service checkup at your local Chevy dealer. They can save you time and money and get the job done right the first time, worry-free. Go to ChevyDriveChicago.com for current service specials or to schedule a test drive.
All right, welcome in, everybody, to a special edition of the Dave Plyer Show, the Far Out 70s. Few life moments were left unchallenged in the 1970s as Americans witnessed a decade of sweeping social, cultural, economic, and political upheavals, all contributing to an era of social movements, political mistrust, and not surprisingly, rich cultural diversity. On the radio and on vinyl, we listen to Kiss, Fleetwood Mac, Earth, Wind, and Fire, The Eagles, The Cars, The Clash, AC/DC, Styx, REO, Stevie Wonder, Elton John, Donna Summer, and the beginnings of Bruce Springsteen. It was also the decade of disco. Over 25 million video game systems made their way into our homes. We went to theaters to watch American Graffiti, The Godfather, Star Wars, Halloween, Network, Jaws, Animal House, and Saturday Night Fever. TV brought us intelligent humor with The Mary Tyler Moore Show, Taxi, and The Bob Newhart Show. It also brought controversy with All in the Family, Good Times, Maude, and The Jeffersons. And it also provided some escape with The Brady Bunch, Happy Days, Three's Company, The Love Boat, and The Carol Burnett Show. We watch crime dramas like Columbo, The Rockford Files, and Kojak, and the 70s introduced us to J.R. Ewing on Dallas. It brought us MASH, the groundbreaking miniseries Roots, and the long-running Saturday Night Live. Most certainly, the 70s represented a profound shift in American society and culture. So tonight is our radio special, The Far Out 70s. We'll feature conversations with Christopher Knight of The Brady Bunch, Jimmy Walker of Good Times, Henry Winkler of Happy Days, Suzanne Summers from Three's Company, Gene Simmons from Rock and Roll Hall of Fame band Kiss, Alan Alda of MASH, and Rob Reiner of All in the Family. First up, it's Christopher Knight, Peter of The Brady Bunch.
Hi, you guys. I'm packing my stuff.
What's all this stuff doing now? You aren't going camping till Saturday.
I know, but I want to make sure I don't forget anything.
Not this time.
What's so special about this time?
Well, it's my first overnight camp out with just the guys.
Hey, come on, you guys. Let's play free throws in the wastebasket.
We better not. Mom will get mad.
No, she won't. Nobody's home. Set it up again.
Big Pete Brady intercepts and goes for a shot.
Mom's favorite vase.
She always says, don't play ball in the house.
You know, I know how close you are to your TV siblings, but I must say, you're the Brady that looks exactly the same that he did 50 years ago.
You know, Dave, I think you're crazy. But okay, thank you, I think.
20 glasses.
50 years, I think that we all, as we all age, we all miss the aging that is going on around us. And at least I look, I guess, I'm a good representation of what I used to be still.
Yeah,
but I have aged. Believe me.
You look good, brother. And I know you have never turned your back on the show for all these years. You've embraced it.
It's almost as though we knew this was going to occur. So our view and our opinions of the time are so totally different than what people assume it must have been. We look back on this thing having taken place or rolled out over 50 years, that in some way we always knew it was going to be like that. But when we were on the air, we were struggling to stay on the air. Yeah, we were picked up only in one season, I believe it was season 4, for an entire season. All other seasons, we were picked up for a half a season, the first half and then the second half, first half and then second half. And you're always waiting to hear whether or not you rated well enough for the network to pick you up.
That's amazing.
We knew we were in the mix. We were a show with a 30 share, which meant that 30% of the country was watching, the 30% of the television audience was watching us on Friday night. Which is huge compared
Massive.
To today.
Absolutely.
And that would have been at the time about 30 million people. But still, that placed us in, about 28, 29, 30. When you're looking at top 10 or top 20 shows, we wouldn't have made that. We would have made, at times, top 30. So, yeah, we've become part of the American tapestry, if you will. Maybe we are now the quintessential representation of American family, but it's taken 50 years to sort of assume that that esteemed position.
And you did some acting before the show. I mean, you were on Mannix, I think was one of the episodes that you're on. So you did a little bit of acting, but I know there was like 250 kids that auditioned for this role, right?
I did a little bit of acting. I did very little, though, with respect to like having dialogue. Mm-hmm. I did a lot of commercials. But the dialogue thing was a little challenging for me. Yeah, I would learn later in life that I was hyperactive, and dyslexic, and that sequence order issue of dyslexia not only affects your reading, but it affects your speech at times too, especially when you're under stress. And though I didn't think anyone was putting me under duress, there was, the issue to perform that required me to get the words out in the correct order, which meant I couldn't. You know, they all come out at the same time. So that was a struggle for me as a kid. Others had much more acting, if you will, experience. Luckily for me, Sher wasn't really looking for actors. He was looking for kids who could act. And what he was looking for is, in essence, he was looking for a kid who, when they got in front of the camera, remained a kid, a real child, but somebody who also they could expect would get the work done in the time frame. And I know that when they had apprehensions about it, they clearly figured out over time, over the first couple episodes, that I wouldn't say my abilities were limited, but that I needed my own way of working. And so there was one episode in that first season that was written around Peter. And I now look back at it and realize what they were wondering is whether he could handle it or not. And that was the hero episode.
Yeah.
And it actually settled me down. The additional attention, because mostly what happens when you're a kid, you get your script the day before you start filming. We film over 3 days. They break the script down into, about 10 pages, about 30 pages in the script. So 10 pages, 10 pages, 10 pages over 3 days. And you're on, a number of those pages. Of course, if it's your episode, you're on a lot of those pages.
Sure.
Normally, you would just go home and you'd be memorizing your lines with your parents. And the joke is, if you want to find a good kid actor, find a parent who's a good actor, because the kid is going to parrot the line reading that their parent gives them the night before.
Sure.
That's what they're going to memorize. But when it came down to this episode, they saw a need to have the dialogue coach spend extra time with me. And that really, that time and that attention really, really helped. And as a result, sort of from that point forward, any time a kid had, or one of us had, or were featured in a particular episode, this was a tactic that was used on everyone, so that there was extra attention given, not just by mom and dad, but by members of production to prepare the child for, big hunks of dialogue and so forth that weren't normally there episode after.
Well, it gave you a greater level of confidence, obviously.
Absolutely, because it wasn't like it was a cold start. You'd been working already, and it's the way actors work when they're adults.
Sure.
It was paying respect, and I came alive with that kind of attention and validity, I suspect.
Well, and then there was such great chemistry between all of you, so I have to think that, especially that first season, doing all that brought you so much closer together. But you also created a lot of great friendships on this show that have lasted a lifetime, Chris.
Other than my own brother and sister, there's no one on this planet whom I've maintained a relationship with longer than my Brady Sips.
That's great. That's great. I was watching an old interview of Ann B. Davis, because I'm a big dork. It was from 25 years ago on Conan O'Brien. And she said when she was on the show, because she was single all of her life, but when she was on the show, she owned 3 different Porsches. And I thought, man, that's really blurring the lines for me to know that Alice was driving a Porsche. During the series.
He had a little 914, I remember.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Exactly.
And she would, so here's Ann B. Davis. You think about it.
Yeah.
So a Porsche, and she always had tennis shoes on and a tennis racket in her hand, beating a tennis ball when she wasn't working against the wall of the soundstage.
That's awesome. I love that. And that was Christopher Knight of the Brady Bunch. Jimmy Walker of Good Times coming up next on 720 WGN.
All right, next on our radio special, The Far Out 70s, is actor and comedian Jimmy Walker, who left an indelible mark in the history of television with his portrayal of J.J., the oldest son of the Evans family, in the 1970s Norman Lear sitcom, Good Times.
From Television City in Hollywood. Good times. Anytime you need a payment.
Good times. Anytime you need a free. Good times. He rose to fame on the stand-up circuit, 5 seasons on Norman Lear's Good Times, and radio runs through his blood. And to talk about it all, Jimmy Walker joins us tonight. Welcome in, Jimmy.
Thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule.
Oh, not busy. Never busy for you, sir. Absolutely not. Radio runs through your blood. I mean, you've been doing radio on and off for decades.
Decades. I kind of quasi started in radio back in New York. I for a brief period of time, I worked at LS there, your rival.
Yep.
You know, so radio is great. I love talk, and we'll see what happens, you know. You listen to Talkers Magazine, you never know.
That's right, that's right.
Michael Harrison, you don't know what he's going to say next.
I love it, I love it. Well, you know, and looking back, you know, at stand-up and really when you first started, you know, legendary comedian Dick Gregory used to come on the Merv Griffin Show all the time, and he had a book out that you read cover to cover, and it kind of really inspired you to pursue comedy and say to yourself, yeah, I can do this.
Yeah, Dick Gregory, who's actually a Chicago native, well, yep. St. Louis native, but spent a lot of time
Midwest.
In Chicago.
Yep.
And Dick's book, which is the N-word, you can't say it anymore now. In those days, you could. Dick's book was just excellent. It's really actually one of the rare first books that I ever read in my life.
Yeah.
So I read it from cover to cover, and Dick was a major influence on me. Unfortunately, he just passed away about a year and a half ago.
Yep, yep.
And I think, you know, comedy since then has changed drastically. I'm actually, I appreciate you, oh, heck darn it, reading my book, because you're the one, I guess, who read it.
Yeah, it was just me.
Just you. You're the only one. We have, like, probably have 5,000 stacked up in my garage.
Oh, boy.
But it's like 409-999. I go, hey, some guy in Chicago read it. All right. We got rid of one.
You got rid of one. It was me. Very early on, you were kind of, and you've said this before, you were kind of the angry black guy thing. And at some point, you know, you had people around you that said, you know, we got to make you a little bit more mainstream so we can get you on some other shows. And I know at some point, late comedian David Brenner became kind of a mentor for you. How did you know David, and how did that all come together?
David Brenner's like my big brother.
Yeah.
So you're obviously Jewish, says, you know, Jews have gone through at least as much as black people. And he showed me the way to try to become more commercial. As it stands now, I'm not an urban comedian. It's funny because when owners see me, they think I'm going to be urban, and I'm not. You know, I always call myself the Johnny Mathis of black comedians. So.
Well, I mean, watching you on Letterman for years, I mean, and watching you do stand up there, I certainly never felt that way. I mean, to me, comedy's comedy, you know.
Yeah, it used to be, but it's not. I think the minority comics get away with much more than the white comics. A perfect example: if you watch any urban comic, any black comic, or any Hispanic comic, there will always be a line in there to go, you know, white people are so stupid, or white people have credit, or white people this or that. Now, okay, we have that premise, and that always gets a laugh whenever anybody does. But let's say Jeff Foxworthy got on and says, you know, I hate black people. Private jet's gone, no more private school for his kids.
Oh, yeah.
It's all over.
Oh, yeah.
So urban comics can get away with that, whereas white comics can't.
Well, and you mentioned you're doing something with Norman Lear. Do you think some of the think about the All in the Families. Think about the Good Times and all that other stuff. You know, he's rebooted One Day at a Time with a Hispanic cast. It's been very successful. But do you think that you could put on an All in the Family today or a Good Times today, for that matter?
I think an All in the Family would not work at all.
Yeah.
You know, they tried it again with the Jerry Carmichael show,
mm-hmm.
In a black cast with David Allen Greer.
Right, right, right. Yeah, that's right. Yep.
And it didn't work whatsoever. I think people are too sensitive about everything. I mean, everything offends somebody. And it just makes comedy very, very difficult. with the whole deal. I mean, you look at the Big Bang Theory or something like that. You have to be that generic nowadays. Mm-hmm. And I love Big Bang. I think Jim Parsons, every year for me, deserves an Emmy for carrying that show. I love his work. It reminds me a lot of myself.
It does remind me of your role. Okay, I was going to say that. What he does and what he contributes to that show is kind of how I saw your contribution to Good Times, and you got a lot of crap for what you did on Good Times from even your cast members of how you approached it.
I think that we took an unbelievable amount of heat, for whatever. I never really understood it. I never really got it. But what it did was it eliminated ethnic shows for 10 years.
It did. Okay.
Because the networks did not want to do any ethnic shows.
Yeah,
they'll do dramas now, but comedy they won't do really because they're afraid to offend people. And it's been generational. You know, Cosby, when he did his show, which was excellent, he wanted to do it as the Honeymooners.
Yeah.
And it was 10 years after our show, and the network said, absolutely not, because, minorities are going to be offended that they're not rich black people. So they made them as out of touch with what black lives are as possible.
Interesting insights in all of this. And you're one of the rare people that talks about it publicly, because I think we're all thinking it. I don't think we're all talking about it. Some pretty interesting insight.
Well, thanks for having me on, and I'm sure I'll get my minute and a half on your big show. Long conversation. I heard you for a minute on
I'm not
show.
Taking anything out of here. That was a great conversation. I appreciate it, Jimmy. Thanks again.
Okay, thanks a lot. Appreciate it.
All right, take care. Stay player on 720 WGN, and we're celebrating the Far Out 70s. Henry Winkler is a TV icon. He gained notoriety in a similar role as Fonzie opposite pre-Rocky Sylvester Stallone in a 1973 theatrical film called The Lords of Flatbush. He supported himself at the time by appearing in television commercials and in episodes of series like The Mary Tyler Moore Show, The Bob Newhart Show, and Rhoda. And then came his blockbuster role in the 1970s TV hit Happy Days. He's had countless memorable movie roles in Night Shift, Scream, and The Waterboy. He's played defense attorney Barry Zuckerkorn on Fox's critically acclaimed Arrested Development and now on HBO's Barry. In addition, he's an award-winning producer and director. This is Henry Winkler. Welcome back to the show, Henry.
It's a pleasure to be here.
You know, the show premiered in 74. The original pilot was called New Family in Town. It was taped in 71. It didn't fly, and your character hadn't even been developed yet at that point.
No. You know what? It is, we did it like a little film. So that we shot it all around Paramount Lot. We almost never left Paramount Lot, except when we did the car races or whatever that was.
Mm-hmm.
And then it wasn't working. We were number 48 of all the shows on the air at the time, which was pretty poor.
Yeah, what was the turning point?
1975, Gary Marshall made a deal with ABC and said, you know what, we're going to shoot it in front of a live audience. I have great success with that, with The Odd Couple. Let's try it like that. And it took off and like a rocket, and it became number one.
I think I remember the episode, actually, because I remember it seemed like out of norm of what we were watching those first couple seasons. It was when you were getting married to a stripper. I think it's what
you know what? I did not remember that.
Yeah, it was getting married to the stripper, because I remember the way they changed the set to do it for a live audience, but in the first couple seasons the Cunningham house looked a little different, Arnold's looked a little different, and I remember that being the live episode and how crazy people got. I mean, just when you or Ron or somebody walked out on the stage, the screaming that would happen, so different from what we were watching with the laugh track and so forth the first couple of seasons. It was incredible.
It was pretty amazing. It was amazing for us. Here's the thing. Ron Howard had not really done anything in front of a live audience before. And I'm telling you, he is so powerful as a human being. It was like he took it to a duck to water.
Is that right? That's great.
It was seamless. You know, I was amazed. Because, you know, you have to wait for the laugh. You know, at the crest of the laugh is when you start the next line. If you do it too early, you cut the laugh off. The audience gets confused and frustrated. you know, it's very particular, very detailed to work in front of a live audience. He was amazing.
And the rest is really history, because at that point, the show absolutely took off. I think Happy Days, the theme changed, like everything Rock Around the Clock
got
dumped.
The theme changed because of money. You know, Rock Around the Clock was too expensive. So they wrote a theme song that they could then use forevermore.
Gotcha.
And Charlie Fox, who wrote the theme song, has my very same birthday.
Oh, very good.
Yeah. Small fact.
And
I
think
know these things.
Absolutely. And I think also from a perspective of, because I know that
here's another fact.
Yeah, sure.
The food they put down in front of us in Arnold's was horrific.
Was it really?
Inedible.
So was it even from the craft table? Was it just sitting around all day? I mean,
the craft table was already a French 5-star restaurant compared to what they put down in front of us.
That's lovely. I'll remember that next time I'm watching you take a bite out of something.
Yeah, notice I don't take a lot of bites.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I know the music thing too. I think the next season of Happy Days finally coming out on DVD. That has been hung up by rights issues. But didn't they use Anson a lot to sing a lot of the songs coming out of the jukebox and so forth?
Well, everybody was a singer but me. Anson sang, Donnie sang. I think they both made an album. Scott Baio sang, he made an album.
Right.
They wanted me to make an album, and I said, gentlemen, I cannot sing, and I will not make an album if I can't sing. They said, it's okay. We'll record one note at a time. And I thought to myself, nah, I don't think so.
And then try to put it together, try to edit it all together.
And they would then edit the notes together. And I thought, this is a bad thing. This is bad.
Yeah.
You know, because if there's such a thing as reincarnation, man, I'm coming back as Bruce Springsteen.
I would hope so.
Oh, yes.
I would hope so.
Yeah.
I would hope so. You know, there was something else also I remember in the beginning of the series. The Fonz character did not wear a leather jacket. He wore a windbreaker. What was the windbreaker all about?
They were convinced that I would be associated with crime if I wore leather. So I could do everything but wear leather until Gary Marshall made a deal with ABC and said he will only wear leather when we put Fonzie's bike in the scene. And the ABC said, okay. And on his way back to the studio, that was at ABC, which is in Century City, which is a small enclave in L.A. on the way to the beach.
Okay.
That's where ABC was housed at that time. And on his way back to Paramount Lot, he called the writer's room and said, never write another scene without the bike.
And the rest is history there.
And the rest is history. And now it's in the Smithsonian.
Isn't that something? I've seen that. I've seen that at the Smithsonian. That's pretty cool. I mean, you're there with Archie Bunker's chair and Kermit the Frog and all kinds of other great iconic items.
It is amazing. Yeah. Tell you the truth.
Yeah. Well, your character and the show became such a cultural phenomenon at that time. And, I mean, you went quickly from a supporting player to one of the stars of the show. And I got to assume that the success and visibility came very quickly. Was it overwhelming?
Very quickly.
Was it overwhelming at the time?
You know, it was overwhelming just because more people talked to me than I knew in my life.
Sure.
You know, and they stopped me everywhere I went, and I couldn't get over that. I went to Little Rock, Arkansas, to make a personal appearance, and 3,000 people were at the airport at 11:30 at night. And I thought, oh my goodness,
I'm here.
If I walk through this, I'm spoiling somebody's party. And somebody said, the party is for you.
Wow,
that was amazing.
Absolutely was.
Yeah.
Absolutely was.
Yeah.
Now, I know Gary Marshall kept everybody's head on straight during all the success by having you guys play softball, which I think is brilliant because it creates such a team effort. And you played all over the world, but you also played softball right here at Wrigley Field.
We sure did.
Yeah.
And, you know, we got jackets from the team, bats. My father got lost in that baseball stadium. We were supposed to go to the hotel afterwards and spent 2 hours looking for my father, who was walking around chatting with people in the stands.
Oh, that's awesome. I love that.
It's true.
But you weren't a big player, sports player at the time. I mean, you really did. You who did you learn from? Like, who taught you how to play and so forth? And you were a pitcher.
Well,
I believe,
you know,
right?
What? The team.
Okay.
Ron Howard bought me my first glove, and Anson bought me a bat for my birthday. I don't have good eye-hand coordination, you know, because I am so learning challenged. I never have played ball before, and I learned to pitch. And they were then Walter Von Huene, who was the script consultant. He would help us memorize our lines. In between takes, in between scenes, he would teach me to pitch.
Oh, that's cool.
And I then traveled all over the world with the team, and I played for the first time, and I felt wonderful that I was playing a sport.
But isn't that so true, even from any business perspective, to create kind of that team effort and that team environment really helps bond people together?
Oh, without a doubt. We were truly a family.
Yeah.
We would play charades on Saturday night at the director's house, rest in his soul, Jerry Paris, who unfortunately passed away.
Yeah.
But
we,
the cast, would have killed for him.
No, I bet. I bet. He started off, I believe, Jerry was from the Dick Van Dyke Show originally. And then
He was the dentist. He was the next-door neighbor.
Jerry Helper.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
We're going to talk about Henry's favorite episodes, working with Ron Howard, his movie career, and so much more, all next on 720 WGN.
Fonzie, it's just a motorcycle.
Just a motorcycle, Mr. C? And I suppose your mother was just a mother.
Like gray sky, hello blue.
Hello, blue.
Something hold me when I hold you.
What an amazing cast and crew, Henry, that you got to work with. Gary Marshall, Jerry Paris, writers like Lowell Gantz, Babalu Mandel, Fred Fox, as well as your co-stars, Ron Howard, Marion Ross, and Tom Bosley.
Tom, I had seen on Broadway before I ever got to California. He won the Tony Award for playing Mayor LaGuardia in Fiorello.
Oh, okay.
And it was a really successful musical at that time. And I had seen it, and then all of a sudden, boom, there I was on the set with him.
Pretty incredible.
Yeah, it was pretty incredible.
Yeah, and there were so many notable guest stars as well. I mean, and when I say guest stars, some of these folks were, you know, it was many before their time where they were big. Tom Hanks, Robin Williams, throwbacks like Frankie Avalon, Cheryl Ladd, John Hart, who was the original Lone Ranger, Buffalo Bob Smith, Hank Aaron. I mean, it was really the who's who guested on the show.
I had my script signed by Hank Aaron.
Is that right? That's great.
Yeah. And Phil Silvers, who
right.
At the beginning of television comedy, his daughter played Jenny Piccolo.
Right, that's
right. And he came to visit. Oh, my gosh.
He played her father on the show, too, didn't he?
Yeah, he might have, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
But the Lone Ranger gave me a silver bullet.
That's,
I still have the silver bullet.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
That's fantastic. There are so many memorable episodes from 11 years and 255 episodes. What were some of those standouts that you just remember and say, wow, that was just an incredible time?
The one that where Chachi was in the ring in a boxing match, and I remember because my daughter was two at the time, and she would come to the audience in the afternoon, the test audience, when we were just working out the jokes.
The run-through. Mm-hmm.
Yes, the run-through. And she would come and watch that. And when the boxer, and I unfortunately don't remember his name, started going after Chachi, she stood up in the audience and started to yell, "Don't you dare hit Scott! Don't you hit Scott!" I just thought that was amazing.
Absolutely.
The whole, everybody just froze.
That's great. That was, I think, at the end of the series, like there was the last season or two or something like that. That he, I remember that episode.
Well, you know, he had to step into Ron's shoes when Ron decided that he was going to become a director.
Director, right?
Yeah,
right. which leads me to, you know, one of his first movies was a movie that you and Michael Keaton starred in, which was Night Shift, which was hysterical. And Shelley Long, too.
You know what? I love that movie still. I think it holds up.
Totally.
And Ron said, you can play either role. And I thought, well, Billy Blaze is kind of like the Fonz.
Absolutely.
So I'm going to play Richie.
Yeah. Oh, it was a completely different role. I mean, when people went and saw you there, I'm sure they thought, wow. I mean, that's what, of course, what acting is all about. And you're an absolutely fabulous actor. So seeing something like that in a whole different light.
You know what? That's a very nice thing to say.
Oh, absolutely. I mean it all the way.
Thanks.
I loved.
I don't know if it was not necessarily the right choice, because it was too much of a shock to the audience who was coming to expect the Fonz.
Yeah, but you know, you got to, but to make it interesting, I think that's exactly what you're doing. Is it would have been something everyone would have expected you to be that exact same role, and how fun would that be? You can see it every week. Something different
right.
is what's a little more exciting, right?
Yes, absolutely. I love that movie so much. You know, it's when I see it now, all these years later, because it came out. And actually, they marketed it wrong. The studio sold it to kids. And it was really 18 to 39.
Yeah, definitely.
And it only became a hit when it got on cable.
Well, that's where I saw it. Because I was too young to watch it really when it was first on. Because, I mean, there were strippers and prostitutes, and I can't imagine how they marketed this to kids.
Yeah, but they made it. They even made the poster. Yeah. They made it into a cartoon.
Oh, okay. Oh,
so
right. It was animated.
It looks
That's
like an
right.
animated.
Forgot about that
poster.
I forgot about that. Absolutely, absolutely.
And I think it got the. I think it got the award for the worst campaign of the year.
Did it really? But you know what? Cable is a lot where people discover some of these movies. I mean, that's really where some of these things become absolute classics, is because they're played, especially back in the 80s and 90s when cable was still kind of fresh and new. That's where everybody discovered a lot of this stuff.
That's
where people are discovering Happy Days, is watching, you know, The Hub or TV Land or some of the classic TV networks that are out there right now. That's how my kids discovered it.
Yeah, and thank goodness, because, you know, what is amazing is that parents are sharing Happy Days with their children. And they seem to laugh in 2014 the way they did in 1974.
Well, a lot of that is because, I mean, this is a period piece. So, you know, there's not a lot of, you know, jokes that were, you know, when you watch shows that are about the 70s in the 70s or about the 80s in the 80s, things can date very quickly. Being this was an iconic show that was a throwback to a different era.
That's why Gary Marshall did that on purpose. When he made it in the 70s and he said it in the 50s,
right.
He did that so that it would be timeless. That you could tell moral stories, and it never seemed like you were being hit on the head. It just seemed like, oh, that's the way they must have lived then. Except that all the stories were relevant for the kids watching it when they first saw it.
Well, and there were life lessons too. I remember, I was born in 67, so I was, you know, as a kid when I was watching the show, it was my favorite show on television at the time. And I remember the library card episode where. You know, I don't know if you guys were asked to do this. You know, the Fonz has such a powerful voice, but let's talk about getting a library card, and the world went and got library cards.
Yeah. That was an amazing, amazing moment. Because when I said one sentence to Richie, and I said, hey, look, you could get a library card for free. And you could meet a girl there. Registration for library cards went up 500%.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
Think about the power of that show. You did something else, too, and I forgive me, I can't remember exactly the reason, but it was about kids having trouble expressing their feelings or their emotions.
Their emotions.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
And you did something where I think Ron Howard was in an accident and it was in the hospital and it was showing, you know, you as the Fonz showed, you know, your emotions and how to, you know, you can let it out.
Yeah, Gary got a letter from a home up in New York State that housed wayward boys who would not show their emotion. And they said, could you do something? Because they love Happy Days. They love the Fonz. Maybe if you show the Fonz being emotional, that would strike a chord. And that's where the crying over his, over him in the hospital room came from.
Sure. Well, a lot of impact. You know, it was a lot of fun. It was a lot of great music. It was a lot of great laughs, but a very impactful show as well. And again, 40 years ago, still blows my mind.
Yeah, me too. Yeah. Me too. I'm very proud that I was part of that ensemble. Yeah, so I am living. You better be very careful what you ask for. I'm not kidding. I am a lucky, lucky human being on this earth.
You're having a good time, too.
Yeah, I am.
All right. Henry, thanks so much for spending some time with us tonight.
What a pleasure to chat with you.
Same here. All right. Talk soon. It's Dave Player on 720 WGN. All right. It's Dave Player on 720 WGN. And welcome back to our 70s TV flashback. So Suzanne Somers was at the height of her career, winning accolades and the public's admiration for playing blonde Chrissy Snow on ABC's hit Emmy-winning comedy Three's Company, alongside John Ritter and Joyce DeWitt. And to talk about life on the sexy 70s sitcom, here is Suzanne Somers. How did you get the role?
I got a call from ABC for a show called Three's Company, and they're really interested in you. So I went in really not caring, and I think that's how you get a part.
And, I think you're right.
I wasn't desperate. I wasn't trying to please. I was just like, this is my last interview.
Yeah.
And it was almost like, what a relief. And now I can kind of focus my life on something that I actually could pull off. I could pull off teaching cooking. And so I read. They said, thank you very much. I drive home. And the phone rings. And it's this kind of sort of kind of an agent who wasn't really, no papers, nothing. She said, oh, my God. You got the part. And I said,
wow.
I was so over. I said, what part? She said, Three's Company. And
wow.
I couldn't believe it. Again, this surreal thing happened. And I walked onto the set that first day with John Ritter and Joyce DeWitt, who were both so highly trained, feeling inadequate. And I told them all, I said, I just have to tell you, I have a supreme interest in this craft, but it was cut short by life events, and I will do everything I can to pull this off and learn. And there was one producer of Nichols, Ross & West, Mickey Ross, who was an old vaudevillian, and he took me under his wing, kind of like Henry Higgins took Eliza Doolittle under his wing.
Yep.
And he worked with me in the way that, remember Nadia Comaneci and her coach?
And her coach, yeah. How, yep, yeah.
Remember, and remember Nadia do a flip on the board, and she first thing she'd do, not listen to the audience, she'd look over
to
at
her coach.
Her coach.
Absolutely.
And he'd either give her a thumbs up or a thumbs down. Well, that's how
that's a relationship.
Mickey Ross worked with me. I would do a scene, and when I finished, I looked right at him, and he'd call me over, and he'd either give me a thumbs up or a thumbs down, and he taught me to hear the music of comedy. And I remember one day, if you watch the episodes, it's fun that these are all going to be out. The year one, I was hanging on by my claws, and I think I succeeded because it was so raw. It was so unpolished. It was so naive, and I was so naive. I even looked different. I'd
right.
never had my hair or makeup done
yep,
professionally.
Right. Yeah.
By year two, professional people had started taking over my hair and makeup, and my look was changing, and I met this one hairdresser, Bjorn, who was always stoned, and he said to me one day, baby.
And probably very creative, by the way.
Very creative. And he said, I think Chrissy Snow should have snow-white hair and big pink cheeks and dark eyes, and I said, do it. So he made my hair snow white, and that's when the character really took off, because I looked in the mirror, and I looked like Chrissy Snow. And so one day, in kind of three-quarters of the way through the second season, I'm watching John Ritter and it hit me. Oh, comedy is musical. It's set up, set up, beat. I'm musical. I always got the leads in all the musicals. I get music. And that was when it took off. I got it. I was able to give her a moral code, what she would and wouldn't do,
sure.
In a way that the audience would anticipate her, because they knew what she would and wouldn't do. It's delicious to do a character when the audience laughs before you do it.
Right, right.
They know
just the anticipation, exactly. Yeah.
Exactly, so.
Well, did the producers allow you to develop the character, or did they completely control what was happening in front of the camera, or did you have a piece of that?
Well, after a while, the chemistry and the dance between John Ritter and myself, Jack and Chrissy, became so enormous that they, what we rehearsed in the rehearsal room was there. But they had isolated cameras on both of us, and because it was tape and not film, you didn't have to be so specific as to hit your mark. On tape, the whole set is lit. If you're doing a film series, you can't ad lib because it's only lit for that X that's on the floor. It's very, I find film very limiting in that way. And so when the audience would laugh at something we didn't anticipate in rehearsal, Jack and Chrissy would keep on going. And those were those delicious moments that couldn't be written. They were just incredible.
Initially, my folks would not let me watch the show that first season. They finally warmed up because I think they realized it was probably less about the sexual references and double entendres and more the just the fun, simple slapstick humor that really kind of took over the show. And in the first 4 years, even though the critics weren't fond of the show was consistently in the top 10. Three of the four seasons that you were on, or the first four seasons, it was number two for the first 2 years, number three. It was really the golden age of the series when you were on.
And at a time that will never happen again, only three choices. It was ABC, NBC, and CBS,
right,
and
right.
Everybody was watching ABC because
true.
Of that Tuesday night lineup with
Happy Laverne Days,
Shirley, Three's Company, and Happy Days.
Right.
It was really quite a powerhouse night. It's funny that it was considered risque in light of what's on TV today.
Oh yeah,
it was non-sexual. I mean, nothing was ever going on
right.
in that house. Chrissy Snow was finally kissed, I think, in the last season. And that was that scene where Jack and Janet, who really were the parents, were pacing and where is she and where is she? I knew we shouldn't have let her go out. If you really analyze it, if I was the child and they were the parents.
Right.
And Jack opens the door and there I am with my arms around my date's neck, his arms around my waist, and my feet were in the air, bowed out, one going one direction, one going the other, the way you would expect Chrissy Snow would
yeah.
get kissed for the first
yeah.
time.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
The most non-sexual kiss ever on television. So it was really, there was something very safe about the series. I don't know why the critics at that time didn't want to like Three's Company. There's something about it that irritated the press. We never got good press.
So much more to talk about with Suzanne Summers next on 720 WGN. It still was a top 20 show, but it wasn't the same. It wasn't number one, number two, number five.
Right.
It dropped quite a bit. And it's a shame that it broke some of the personal relationships.
Oh, it's terrible.
You had
it's an interesting story. This Mickey Ross, who took me under his wing, I believe, this is my belief, that in that process he fell in love with me in the way that a father would desire his daughter but knows it's wrong. And so there was never any overtures. But when I married Alan Hamill, his demeanor towards me changed so much. And when the day of the negotiation came,
mm-hmm.
When my contract was up, it was my husband, who was then my manager, who went in to ABC, the lawyer's office. His name was George Sunderland, and Mickey Ross was sitting there. And my husband always describes the scene. He walks in, and Mickey Ross is a chain smoker, and he smokes with his thumb and his first finger, one of those kind of smokers.
Mm-hmm.
And he's sitting there smoking kind of violently. And my husband says, as you realize, Suzanne has, you know, brought enormous visibility to the show, and she's got the highest demographics of any woman in television. every year. She's on a minimum of 40 to 50 national magazine covers. She's been featured in Barbara Walters and had her own specials and everything, and yet the men are making 10 to 15 times more. So she would like you to pay what she's paying some of the men. And Mickey Ross took his cigarette and threw it on the floor of the ABC lawyer's office and stomped it out on the floor and comes over to my husband and leans over him and says, "You want me to share my blood with her?" And my husband leaned forward and said, "Yes." And he said, "She's fired." And that was
wow. Wow.
And then fired was one thing, but they forced me to work off
your contract.
Contract.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's when they relegated me to 1 minute at the end of the show, a phone call from my sick aunt's house calling Jack and Janet, who I never saw again or talked to. I was just talking to a dead telephone.
It's amazing.
And would say, "Oh, I miss you so much, but she's still so sick, and I don't know when I'll be back." And that went on for the rest of the season. When they show the episodes, they never show those 1 minute because they're pathetic. And sometimes when I think about it, it was so crazy because they would have a guard meet me out at the back door. We were taping at CBS, even though it was an ABC show. Walk me into a cordoned-off corridor. I wasn't allowed to interact or see anybody else in the show.
That's
like
so
a prisoner.
Horrible. Yeah.
I'd go in. My hair and makeup person would do my beauty stuff, and then I'd be taken out to this poorly lit little corner set away from the other set. I didn't see one person from the crew, a chair, a lamp, and a telephone, and I'd do my minute and then go home. And I would leave crying every week because it was so wrong. It
yeah.
was so wrong. So it was, I think after that, there were, I remember at one of the NAPP or whatever the convention is where they sell syndicated
yep.
shows,
yep.
I think it's NAPP. One of the executives got up and said, the loss in syndication fees with the firing of Suzanne Summers is in the untold millions and maybe more, because the shows without the Chrissy Snow character just don't get the same revenue as the other ones.
I bet.
So I think after that, the next one who asked for money was Roseanne, and they gave it to her. No problem. She got $750,000
mm-hmm.
a week. And people go, $750,000? Well, if you knew what the back-end revenue, if you knew that this goes into billions,
yeah.
it's chump change. And this business is one that there are no guarantees. If you go to law school, you'll be a lawyer. If you go to med school, you'll be a doctor, and you're going to make an income. Some are better than others, of course. You are an actor, or you study acting, or you have ability. You're never guaranteed that you will ever, ever get a job. Think of all the talent that's sitting there that will never be seen or heard. So if you do hit it, if you do luck into a Three's Company, it's your golden moment and to make the most of. And I had never had any money in my life, and I felt very deserving of it, that
yeah.
I sold as many tickets as any of those men that were getting paid those enormous salaries. So.
Sure, sure. Now, I know you said you didn't really speak to anybody for so many years now, and I know you had Joyce DeWitt on your show a couple of years ago on YouTube, and I remember when it came out, and I remember where I saw it on social media, where I saw it, that it was happening, and I remember watching it that day. It was such a sense of urgency to see the two of you together, and I'm looking at it on YouTube now, 1.1 million views.
Mm-hmm.
That must have been pretty emotional.
Yes, and, you know, I would like to take credit for doing something that extraordinary, but we were doing this, my Breaking Through series, which was a 7-minute daily show, as determined by the interest on the Internet. No one will watch anything longer than 7 minutes these days.
Yeah, fair enough.
On the Internet. And one of my young producers in New York came up to me and nervously said, "I took the liberty to call Joyce DeWitt to see if she wanted to come on your show, and she's amenable to it if you'll talk to her first." And I said, I got mad at her. I said, "Who gave you the authority? I've never talked to her. We don't talk to each other." So I go back to my hotel room that night. I'm lying in bed in the dark, and I thought, how stupid, Suzanne. How small. How unevolved, Suzanne. And I went in the next day, and I said, "Forgive me for my knee-jerk reaction. You are so right. What a brilliant idea." She said, well, the only caveat that Joyce has is that she'd like to talk to you first. And I said, absolutely. So I called Joyce the night before, and she said, I just want to make sure you don't ambush me. And I said, oh, my, you don't, it's been years, and so I would never do that. I would not have done that even then either. I said, I think this will provide closure for you, for me, for those who cared about that show.
Yeah.
I said, I have one thing I want to ask you. And she said, yeah. I said, I would like to not see you before the show. I would like the moment that we see each other for the first time in 30 years to be the moment that is on the air.
Oh, you could tell.
She agreed to that.
You could tell, yeah.
When she came out, that was, and it was genuine. My heart just flooded with feelings at that moment of these two women shared a moment in time like no one else ever will again. There will never be that kind of narrow focus on one particular program because we have such diversity now and the internet, which didn't even exist then.
Right.
And weren't we lucky? And that's what I really wanted to just provide closure and gratitude and you know, remember the good things.
Well, it just tells you the power of the show and the role it played in the world of pop culture and television history.
And the power of forgiveness.
Absolutely.
You know, it's a gift to give yourself. And I'd had the opportunity to talk to John 1 month before he died. 30 years had gone by. And I'm having my hair, I'm in the shampoo bowl at a beauty salon, and the receptionist comes up and says, you have a phone call. And I said, can you take a message? I'll call back. She said, it's John Ritter. And I sat up with my wet hair, and I went into this little back room, and there was John. And he said, look, I forgive you, which I had to deal with that a little bit.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Right. Oh, well, okay,
yeah.
All right. And it was just a bit of a, wow, we're coming from two different places.
Right,
but I said,
right.
I went past that, and I said, I can't even tell you what it means to me to talk to you. And he said, look, I'm doing a show called 8 Simple Rules, and the writers have written this dream sequence that in my dream, Janet and Chrissy are in the dream. And I said, you know, people have wanted to see a reunion for so long. I just feel there's a better way to do it. And I said, I have wanted to work with you ever since I left that show. There was something about you and I that was magic. I don't know if it's a continuation of these two characters or it's two that are like it or something completely different, but we have magic together. And if you won't take this the wrong way, now that we've rekindled, let's look for that project. And we both agreed, let's look for that project. And then a month later, he was gone.
And that was Suzanne Summers of 70s sitcom Three's Company, which can be seen on Antenna TV. Gene Simmons from KISS is next as our radio special, The Far Out 70s, continues on 720 WGN.
It's Dave Plyer on 720 WGN. For true fans of rock and roll, it's hard to imagine a time when KISS didn't exist. Known as rock's ultimate showman, Gene Simmons co-founded the hard rock supergroup KISS in the early 1970s. And since then, KISS has sold more than 80 million albums, awarded over 30 gold records, and performed more than 2,000 shows around the world. Late last year, Gene's new 10-CD box set, The Vault, was released and spans from 66 to 2016 with 150 songs that have never been released. Also, a career-spanning single disc best of KISS World was released to coincide with a massive world tour. Gene sang the lead vocals on hits like Rock and Roll All Night, Calling Dr. Love, and A World Without Heroes. And joining us to talk about it all is rock and roll legend Gene Simmons. Gene, welcome in, my friend.
Boy, do I feel better. What a build-up. Unbelievable.
What a career, man. I mean, seriously.
I mean, I feel like kind of a big deal now.
You? Oh, man, you are a big deal. Are you kidding me? You're a big deal. Well,
wow.
I got to tell you, I was reading, you know, you're going back on tour with KISS in July, and this appearance here in Chicago, you've got your own band, you're going to play some hits, but, you know, this is an opportunity also to hear some uniquely obscure stuff as well.
The Gene Simmons Band started kind of as a, you know, life happens to you while you're busy making plans. I was a keynote speaker at a convention in Vancouver called YPO. And so they said, listen, you're going to be speaking, and there are kind of important people there, Prime Minister Trudeau and all kinds of, you know, cool people.
Mm-hmm.
"Would you, Gene, would you mind getting up on stage and singing a few tunes?" And I explained, you know, it's not as easy as that. You got to put a band together and all that. And you guys can't afford Kiss, so I don't know what I can do. Well, he said, "Listen, here's X amount of dollars." And I said, "Sure." So I called some pals in Nashville, and we put together a band over the phone and without rehearsing. I told them which tunes I want to play. Without rehearsing, I gave them the key, and we just showed up and played. And I will tell you, the word chemistry isn't just something you learn in high school. When you meet people, either you got it or you don't.
Sure.
That's in music, at work, in love, in hate. Either there's chemistry or there isn't. And there was. And it since we started, we've done over 50 shows, headlining rock festivals in Czech Republic, Canada, all over the place. It's grown into quite a thing. Now, I'm not leaving Kiss. We're doing great. We're having a great time playing stadiums and arenas, blah, blah, blah. But this Gene Simmons Band thing has become, grown a life of its own. So even, you know, the fans that show up, you got to remember the word fan comes from the word fanatic. Mm-hmm. And so we get a chance to play stuff that Kiss will never play, stuff off the solo records. And we've got a 44-year history, obscure stuff off of The Elder. I mean, stuff the fans have been clamoring for.
That's cool.
That Kiss can play. I don't mean physically. I mean, when you got 10 to 50,000 people at a concert, they want to hear what they know.
There's expectations. Yeah, yeah.
Well, sure. If I go see the Stones, I want to hear Satisfaction.
Right.
When they play, you know, when they play something obscure off of a 1995 record, you know, the audience sits down, except for the diehards. So the folks who come to see the Gene Simmons Band are diehards, and they want, you know, special stuff, and that's what we do.
I love that.
The other thing is people can YouTube it, go on YouTube, and you'll see how we invite folks up on the stage, kids who play instruments and sing, and then the whole audience, as much as we can get on the stage, join us to sing I Love It Loud and Do You Love Me, and even Rock and Roll All Night, anywhere from 60 to 100 people, so that you can video it, send it to your friends, and all that. So, I mean, the bottom line is we have a ball.
Yeah, it's an experience. I love that you do that, and I love that you bring whoever wants to come up, musicians, singers, whoever, to experience that with you. I think that's what makes the concerts that you've been doing so unique and
really
so special.
Really talented young folk who, you don't have to bring a guitar. We have extra guitars.
That's great.
You can go on YouTube and plug in 13-year-old drummer joins Kiss for nothing to lose. I'm sorry, joins Gene Simmons Band for nothing to lose.
Yeah.
And it'll blow you away. There's a 15-year-old chick guitar player who gets up on stage with us and just blows everybody away. Unbelievable.
That's
the
awesome
talent that's out there. Yeah.
That's awesome. That's awesome. And here we are, Gene, 45 years later. I mean, a legacy that has lasted nearly five decades. And, you know, I read one of your books about when you got inspired to do all this and get into music, and it was all about seeing the Beatles on Sullivan for you, wasn't it?
Yeah, that changed my life because, you know, I wasn't born in America, and I always felt like an outsider. And all of a sudden, you see these guys on TV, Kooky, like Roth, and all of a sudden, they didn't sound American.
Yeah.
They sounded like they came from someplace else. And it somehow connected with me, and I felt not so different. You know, originally in those days, I spoke with an accent. And so I thought, well, this isn't such a bad job. You get to play, have a good time, the chicks like you, and maybe you'll get paid. Maybe I don't have to. I mean, eventually I became a teacher in sixth grade and all kinds of other wacky stuff, but the band thing started right away, and within a year and a half of starting, by 1975, we're playing Anaheim Stadium in California.
It's crazy. I mean, the first band was the Missing Links, and then Long Island Sound's Rising Sun. Wicked Lester, you know, really did lay the groundwork for something even bigger. I mean, that was really what moved the needle, I think, right?
Yes, Wicked Lester was the previous band Paul and I had. We actually had a recording contract with Epic Records. And you know what? We just didn't believe it. They say don't look a gift horse in the mouth. that comes from the Trojan War. You can look it up, kids.
Yeah.
And we decided, I mean, hindsight's 20/20. We looked at each other and said, you know what, we don't believe in this. And we literally walked out of the band that we started because it just didn't tug at the heartstrings. It just didn't feel authentic. And we decided to put together the band we never saw on stage, a band that didn't have any rules, that just didn't try to look or sound like any other band. And here we are today, more gold records than any American band in history, in all categories, I might add.
Yeah.
You know, the Greeks, because I studied Greek philosophy and all that, they said something that actually resonates. To thine own self be true. That's a good idea.
Yeah.
You know, when you're running a race, don't look over your shoulder to see what anybody else is doing. Just do the best you can. Just look straight forward and just run your race.
And I mean, you guys were playing, but you also, you know, you said you were teaching. You know, you did what every aspiring musician did, and you still made a living. You still had a bunch of side jobs at the time that you were doing until you had the opportunity to record a demo tape. And was it at Hendrix Studios? Is that what I read?
Yes, Electric Lady Studios. That's right. We'd done some background vocals for a session. They call it session work, and got a little bit of cash, and instead of taking the cash, got free studio time, and that gave us a chance to do some demos. To make a long story short, you know, there's no journey that you can repeat and figure out. Everybody's got to figure out for themselves. You know, there are a lot of different roads that lead to the top of the mountain, and also, you know, people, I keep writing books about business and stuff like that. People want it shorthand. They go, what are the 10 rules of success? There are none.
No, it's hard work.
There are no rules to success. You can share the, you know, the age-old adage, which is the harder I work, the luckier I get. And that's about all you get. The rest of it is just having the right thing at the right place at the right time and a lot of work.
Well, our radio special is the Far Out 70s, and there's more with Gene Simmons from KISS next on 720 WGN. Stay player on 720 WGN. We're talking to rock legend Gene Simmons of KISS.
You are an entrepreneur. I mean, really, in everything that you've done in music and movies and restaurants and all kinds of stuff. I mean, this is really who you are, and I think that's how your brain has always worked. As you said, you know, you didn't take the money. You took the next step that
you
was
going to... You've got to think about the idea. The money will take care of itself, but you got to think of the big idea and then make it work.
Yeah.
I mean, as I'm talking to you, this month in 1,000 7-Eleven stores in Southern California, my sodas called Moneybag Sodas debut. They will soon ramp up to 10,000 stores, and then I intend to take them around the world to 66,000 stores, but that also includes Rock World, my trademarked business model that's going to bring T-shirts and hats into 7-Elevens. They've never sold that stuff before, so there's a lot of exciting stuff going on. But at the end of the day, I've met people who can't sleep at night. My advice is always work harder during the day. I mean, if you're exhausted, you won't have any problem going to sleep.
That's very true. I like that. That's very true. And you guys did that. You know, you're mentioning, you know, you were signed by a record label. You signed by Epic, then you were dropped by Epic, and you were determined to make this album. And as you said, you know, you didn't see the band on stage that you wanted to see. And you really had a new vision. You and Paul Stanley really had a new vision for really what you wanted to do, to bring music and theater really to the stage.
Yeah, but, you know, it really stemmed from seeing the bands that I loved hearing on the radio, the Love and Spoonful and, the, you know, and everybody. And when you go to see them live, you're looking around going, really? That's it? I mean, there was even a guy named Donovan who put out some decent records that I liked. He used to sit cross-legged on a Persian carpet with incense, bare feet, strumming an acoustic guitar. And I'm thinking, I'm paying full ticket price for that? That's where the term get out of here comes from.
Yeah.
Get out of here.
Yeah, get out
of
here.
So we always wanted to give everybody more. So if you just think to yourself for a second, Paul McCartney, one of the finest, and
Garth Brooks and even wrestlers, all of that stuff. When you see fireworks going on, where do you think that came from? Men Without Hats? That's an obscure band from Canada.
No, I don't. From the 80s, yes. Yeah, that's awesome. And, you know, releasing Alive, did you know that that was going to be the album when you guys put that together, that was going to be the album?
No, we didn't know anything. In those days, nobody released live records until your career was over.
Right, that's right.
And you certainly didn't release a double album before you had your first gold album. But we've always thrown caution to the wind, as the saying goes, and dove into the deep end of the pool and just go for it. You know, you're going to have one chance in life. Go for it. If you're going to lose gloriously.
That's right. But that's how you learn, too.
What doesn't kill you.
Yeah, it makes you stronger. You're absolutely right. How'd you deal with the fame and continue, really, to deal with the fame? Because, you know, you've never... You know, a lot of musicians, and we know the story, a lot of musicians got into booze or got into drugs. It's not something that was ever crossing your path. But what have you done to stay relatively, you know, grounded in all of this, back then and now?
Well, I have a secret weapon, and it's my mother, who had a horrible childhood. She grew up during World War II, and actually... when she was 14, she was in the concentration camps of Nazi Germany. And the wisdom that she gave me as a child continues today. You know, I mean, if you only have 24 hours of life on Earth, what are you going to do? You're going to watch Pokemon reruns? Or are you going to get out there and...
live life.
Yeah, live it. Eat good, love good, work hard, and then you die. Because, by the way, we're all going to get our turn. But while you're alive, I mean, roll up your sleeves and go for it.
Yeah, that's what I think keeps people going. You got to keep doing what you love, right?
And when you stop, your body starts to die.
Yeah.
When water stops moving, it starts to get stale and disease-ridden. It's only if your heart keeps pumping, you'll stay alive and you'll be healthy. You'll sleep good. As soon as you sit around, you'll start to get fat, and you will die.
I think you're right. Well, and you've done exactly that. I mean, you've found new ways and new interests over your lifetime just to keep your brain going a little bit. And I love what you just put out, The Vault. You know, kind of looking back a little bit. But I mean, this is the box set of box sets for anybody who loves any band. There's nothing like this box set. It's called The Vault. What made you, you know, really dig deep and pull all that together? Because, I mean, this spans 50 years.
I've been planning it for 10 years. I'm an only child, so I've had a lot of time to think for myself. And I collected me, you know, Star Wars fans and Marvel Comics fans. I'm a Gene Simmons fan. I know it sounds like, what? But, so I've saved everything.
Yeah.
And along the years, through the years, I've always... written tunes, but very few of them wound up on Kiss records because many of them, well, you know, we've always had more songs that we needed, for one thing. And the other thing is I tried different forms of music, R&B, soul, even semi-country stuff that sounded Eagle-ish, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I always wanted to play the drums and the bass and the guitar and sing all the backgrounds, kind of what McCartney did. So it was a creative outlet for me, and the GeneSimmonsVault.com box set is literally the largest, most comprehensive box set ever released.
Yeah.
Because I don't want to wait until I'm dead for somebody to release something called posthumous. It means he's dead.
Yeah.
But here we found some lost tracks. I want to be here. Why would you throw a party and not be in it?
Yeah, I love that. That's so true. That's so true. And this box set, I mean, it does that. And the fact that you got to control it, too, I mean, that's another thing. You're right. When
people have no idea that it's literally over 3 feet tall, weighs 40 pounds, got metal hardware and stuff. And inside, over the last music that's, 50 years old, all the way to 2016.
Yeah.
Along the way, I've co-written songs with Bob Dylan, three of them that are on the box set. The Van Halen brothers and I, in 1978, came up for three tracks. Joe Perry.
Joe Perry, yeah.
is on the track. All the Kiss guys, Paul and John and Ringo, and see what I did there? See, that was a joke.
I like that.
Yeah. So everybody's on the record, and it's a chance for me to kind of, why would you want to leave anything
in the attic?
Gene, a thrill talking to you. Thanks for taking the time, and looking forward to seeing you in Chicago, pal.
Thank you, boss.
Thank you. All right, it's 720 WGN. Welcome back to the Dave Player Show and our radio special, The Far Out 70s. Next is my conversation with TV legend Alan Alda of MASH. Science was something that was always in your DNA. Your father wanted you to be a doctor, not play one on TV, but become a doctor. But you weren't that great in chemistry.
Well, I didn't want to be great in chemistry, and I wanted to fail the course because I didn't want to be a doctor. I wanted to be a writer and an actor. But it turned out it wasn't that hard to fail the course. I actually excelled at failing.
That's fantastic. How did your interest in science and reading scientific studies begin, Alan?
It must have begun in my childhood because I was always interested in how things were the way they were. How did things get that way? And why are you saying that to that other person? Like, I think that's the beginning of an interest in science, and it only increased as time went on.
And you've had inspiration through science throughout your entire life. But with this new book, it wasn't a doctor visit, but it was a dental visit that inspired this new mission to write your new book.
Well, it was certainly a pivotal moment in my life. The dentist was taking out a front tooth that should have come out decades earlier. And he had some new operation he had invented that was going to pull some of my gum over the socket left by the tooth. It was going to give me a great blood supply for healing. And that all sounded fine.
Yeah.
Then when he had the scalpel right in front of my face before he started to do the operation, he said, "Now there'll be some tethering." And I said, "There'll be what?" He said, "Tethering, tethering, tethering." He started yelling. I didn't know what he was talking about. He never explained it. I didn't know what it. I never did get an explanation, and it altered my smile. I was making a movie a couple of weeks later, and I smiled, and it came out like a sneer.
Mm.
But so that's all right because I've been able to play villains a lot better now.
So, but with that, you know, he kind of loudly barked at you a little bit.
It was really a vivid example of how somebody who's in a position to really communicate something important to you, but something that he knows all about, but you don't know anything about, it's his responsibility to make sure you get it.
Sure.
That's like the essence of the whole process of communicating something to somebody. It doesn't matter how precise you are or how perfect your message is. If it doesn't reach the other person and get in their head and stick with them, you might have saved yourself the time of perfecting your message because the message is only as good as it works.
Well, in this book, and although you're focused very much on scientists communicating better, the book is an amazing tool for all people in their respective careers and beyond to understand the critical importance of connecting to one another.
Yeah, you know, I think the same thing applies if a mother is trying to talk her daughter off a dangerous drug, or a couple is trying to figure out. And it's funny, I talk in the book about how there's this one study that I find it hard to believe that this study is real, that one of the things couples fight the most about is how to load the dishwasher. But it doesn't seem like a strange thing to fight about, but whether or not that's one of the major fights, we all get into disagreements and rub each other the wrong way about trivial things very often. And that makes up the substance of our lives. And yet we could have smoother sailing through all of those waters if we were able to read what was going on in the other person's head. It just calms everything down. As I've been teaching this and working on it with all the people who teach all the people we teach, I've been paying more attention to it. I've been getting more empathy, more understanding about what other people are feeling. Not being sympathetic to it, but just understanding what they're going through. I find people are much less annoying now.
Well, that's good. That's a benefit there. As I was going to say, my wife did give me hell for a long time on how I loaded the dishwasher. Now what she does is when I'm done loading it, I'll walk away and then she'll open it back up and just do it herself.
I've read that's a common solution.
Yeah, exactly.
But isn't that a strange thing that we pick something like that? I wonder if it's territorial. You know, I run the kitchen, whichever sex it is, saying that, or I know how to stack things. Sure. Something about that. My identity is tied up in stacking.
Yeah, right.
It doesn't seem like.
Well, there's more with TV legend Alan Alda from Emmy Award-winning 70s dramedy MASH next on 720 WGN. So you did some radio when you were at Fordham. You were in the ROTC. You did a lot of stage work, nominated for a Tony. You did a lot of early film and television work in Sergeant Bilko in The Twilight Zone and Paper Lion, nominated for a Golden Globe. And you really did a lot more drama than comedy. And then you auditioned for MASH. So, you know, what intrigued you about this role?
Well, it's funny you say that, because if they saw me, I never auditioned for MASH. My work was sort of known from stage and movies, and they just asked me to do it. But it's interesting you say mostly I had done serious parts. So if they got the idea from seeing that I could do MASH, that's an interesting idea.
Yeah.
I had done comedies on Broadway, so I think they knew me from that. I did the Owl and the Pussycat, Diana, sure, the stage version of it before the movie came out. But what intrigued me about it was that it was written so well. The pilot was written by Larry Gelbart, who was a comedy genius. And it was some of the best writing for television I had ever seen. I was a little worried that it might become a trivial, that it might present war in a trivial way. And I waited until the last minute. I was making a movie in a prison in Utah,
right,
when I got the script. So I had to wait till I got out of prison to agree to do the show MASH and to have a conversation with them where we decided that we all agreed that we were going to take the war seriously, that it wouldn't just be off stage. We'd see the results of it.
Which would be, of course.
Didn't bother the audience at all.
No.
That became the hallmark of the show.
Yeah, I love that you wanted to do that. I mean, you didn't want it to be all laughs. It could be some jokes, it could be some laughs, but you really wanted that reality. And that probably best sets it up for what war was all about. I mean, there was moments that I would laugh out loud, and then there was moments that I would really take pause to listen to what you were saying and put myself where you were.
Yeah, thank you. I think that's one of the benefits of watching good drama. And I really, my own personal taste is that I'd like to see a play that shows me the laughter in life and also acknowledges that eventually we're all going to die. Not literally, but that life isn't all laughing, and you laugh anyway.
Sure.
Isn't the laugh sweeter if you laugh anyway than if you just laugh and ignore the fact that there are things not to laugh at?
Well, you bring up a play. I always felt that MASH was a 22-minute play that aired every week. And even though maybe the earlier seasons were a little more comedy than drama, and then maybe the later seasons were a little more drama than comedy, I always felt like I was watching kind of a self-contained play every week. It just seemed like what you were doing on stage.
I don't know why some people have made that distinction, because some of the most serious stuff occurred early in the show's run.
Yeah.
I remember in the first or second year, a patient died on the operating table in a show written by Larry Gelbart, who was a comic genius, I thought. But he had this patient die on the table, and it was a patient, a close friend of Hawkeye's, so there was a big emotional response to it, and that was part of the beginnings of MASH. The network was really worried about getting so deep into the into the parts of war that really hurt, like death and dismemberment and that kind of thing, which is hard to take. But the head of the network said, what is this, a situation tragedy?
Is that right?
But it didn't. The audience didn't mind. I think they took it all in all as for how we meant it, which was to try to reflect the lives of the people who really lived through that experience.
Well, that's what put that human connection in there. Is when Henry Blake,
what you described before of watching a human experience.
I mean, when Henry Blake, died, and I know that was a script that was, you knew about it, but it was a script that was kind of handed to everyone at the last minute, and it was a real reaction, not only from the people on stage, but, I remember it still is that being one of the most poignant moments on television that really set the tone. Well, here's this really funny guy. We've been laughing at the show for the first 3 years here. It's fabulous, but this is the reality of war.
Yeah, and I think Larry Gelbart, who wrote that scene, felt that it could help you understand what it's like when you're talking to your buddy 1 minute and a minute later the buddy is gone.
Right.
And the shock of that, the surprise, I think the whole audience felt who had come to know the characters. The other element in it was a little more human. Larry Gelbart, who wrote the scene, was upset with McLean Stevenson, who played the character who died, and he was upset with him for leaving the show. So he wrote a scene that made it so he could never come back.
Right. Yeah. I mean,
it wasn't all art.
No, not at all. Not at all. And I think what brought that cast together so well in tying that time of your life back to the book, you would sit around and do table reads, but there was a bonding. You told stories about each other's lives. Before you even started reading the scripts, you had deep relationships with these people that ultimately helped you communicate better when the camera was on.
Yeah, and we did that all through the run of the series. We sat in chairs between shots instead of retreating to our dressing rooms. Most of the time we sat together and just laughed.
Yeah.
And that really... That a lot of people talked about the rapport the cast had.
Oh, yeah.
They seemed like they had been living together for those months. And I think that's what did it, is that we really did have a connection that we kept going. We in some ways, we deliberately knew that we were helping the show by that connection we were maintaining.
And, I know it's not easy for you, and you've mentioned this before, to act with someone you really don't know. You like to build up, you talk about trust again and communication. You like to build up some trust and get to know who you're working with before the lights go on.
It's very hard to act with somebody you don't know. You have to pretend to know them. And sometimes you can get away with pretending, but pretending pretty much is pretending, and at some level, conscious or unconscious, I think the audience is liable to figure out that you're pretending. If the more you can have that genuine to work from, authentic, the more you'll behave in a way that's authentic without making yourself do it, without
sure.
putting your face in a position that looks like you're authentic, but you actually are authentic, because there are involuntary muscles that go into play when you have some real relationship with somebody.
Well, you can tell on the set how invested everybody was, and there were moments of MASH that seemed improvised, but there was little of that. It was really just well rehearsed with the trust that was built amongst the cast.
That's true. Most of us were from the theater, and we were very concerned about respecting the written word and everything that was written. We said we would sometimes ask questions about it or ask for changes at the table read, but once the script was set, that was it. And the funny thing was, people did think some scenes were improvised and just happened. The timing would just happen, luckily. In fact, those scenes that looked the most improvised, we sometimes would do 20 takes to get that down so that it was so smooth. It looked like it was just happening.
Here's what I noticed when I've seen some MASH bloopers on the air. A lot of television shows, you know, you can get them on the DVDs and so forth, or they're on YouTube or wherever. And it was always fun and games. Someone messed up, they'd go back, whatever. You and the cast seemed really frustrated when you would flub, because it kind of broke that continuity of what you were trying to communicate. Like, it wasn't as other comedies that would just be laughing off and it would be 10, 15 minutes before they get started again. You guys got right back into it.
Well, yes, except for those times when we would get into a laughing jag because it's late in the afternoon and the lights have sucked all the oxygen out of the air and you're just helpless. Somebody makes some stupid mistake, and then you try to go on, and you can't. They could last 15 or 20 minutes.
Yeah.
And very often, a fellow actor would be directing the show. The day before, when he wasn't directing, he'd be helpless with laughter during the laughing jag period. Now that he's director, he's not laughing. He's saying, come on, people.
Yeah, right. Well, that was you,
whoever
too.
Whoever was in charge really suffered.
Yeah, yeah.
The legendary Alan Alda. And joining us is the man who starred in All the Family and won two of his Primetime Emmy Awards, is actor, writer, director, and producer, the legendary Rob Reiner. Rob, welcome in.
Dave, how you doing?
I'm doing great. Many people might not know this, but Norman Lear had two pilots of All in the Family based on the British TV series Till Death Do Us Part. It was, first a pilot for ABC in 68. It was Justice for All in 69. Those were the days, a second pilot. But different daughters and husbands. Carol O'Connor and Gene were with it all, but different actors both times.
Right. And the first two pilots were done for ABC. And they were two different sets of Mike and Gloria's. And then Sally Struthers and I, I think I had auditioned even for one of them, and I didn't get the part, but I guess I got better as time went by. And then when they did it for CBS, then I got the part, and Sally got it. And so we were the third set of Mike and Gloria.
Well, and you were kind of gearing up, I think, a little bit more for a career still behind the camera. So what made you go for this role and then accept this role?
Well, I mean, you're right. I mean, I was thinking more that I'd be, you know, directing. I'd done theater, like I say, an improv group. But I saw that. I said, this is way so far beyond anything that's ever been done on television. It's, you know, forget the, you know, going to the edge of the envelope. This was ripping up the envelope. You know, I mean, it was just, it had never been done. I said, boy, this is great. And I said, you know, I got to be part of this. And it's not going to last anyway, because, you know, who's going to accept this? You know,
it'll be
on for 13 weeks, and that'll be a great experience, and then I'll go back to doing what I want to do. And so had no idea that, you know, 8 years we'd be doing it.
Well, and the first one had a warning in front of the show, just to tell
people.
Yeah,
they had a disclaimer.
Yeah.
They had a disclaimer. Basically, CBS said, you know, the views of the show is not reflecting on the view. And CBS, basically, it was a disclaimer saying, we don't want to have anything to do with this show.
Yeah, right.
Don't look at it. Pretend we didn't put it on. It's here, but if you know, if you want to go to the other room and get something to eat, go ahead. You know, we don't care about it. But it wound up, success.
And you were okay with that up front, knowing that, okay, this might not go on more than 13 weeks. If the next few, you know, then I'll do something else. I mean, was it ever a thought that this was going to catch on, or were you kind of like tentatively going through the motions and doing it, wondering, oh, I don't know.
Well, I wanted to do it because I knew it was a great show, and the writing was great, and the subject matters were great. And, you know, it wasn't a hit right away. We were on for 13 weeks, and people didn't really pick up on the show. Then they ran those 13 shows back-to-back with the original, and basically we were on 26 weeks in a row. By the end of that, we had caught on, and people were,
absolutely,
you know, and then it was that, you know, that water cooler must-see TV. And the interesting thing about it is, at the time, we were a country of, you know, like 200,000 people. Mm-hmm. I mean, 200 million people.
Right.
You know, maybe a little bit less than 200 million people. And, you know, you had to watch the show when it was on. There was no TiVo. There was no DVR. You had to watch it when it was on.
Yep.
So it meant that anywhere between 40 and 45 million people had a shared experience every Saturday night watching that show. And so it had this explosive reality to it, where the next day, you know, over the weekend, people came back. Did you see what they did? Did you see?
Yeah.
And it was the talk. Now, if you have a, now we're a country of 330 million people, and if you get a show that gets 10 to 12 million people, that's a huge hit.
Yeah, you're right.
And they don't even watch it at the same time.
Right, exactly.
That's, you know,
those water cooler moments aren't happening anymore. And it's funny.
No, they're not happening because everybody's, you know, it's so just fragmented that, you know, you start watching an episode, you know, a series like, you know, right now Your Honor is on, you know, with Bryan Cranston.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll say, "Have you watching Your Honor?" He says, "Yeah, but don't tell me. I'm only on set." You can never discuss it with anybody, you know.
I'm watching six of them.
Don't say. No.
Yeah, or I'm watching six of them tonight. Don't tell me anything that's going to go on. Norman Lear, who created the series, he's going to be 99 this summer.
I know.
You knew Norman when you were a kid and was a friend of your dad's.
Yeah, I mean, I met Norman. I was like, I guess I was like 8 years old or something. And we had houses out at this place in Fire Island, which is a beach community. And I was playing with his daughter. His daughter's my age, Ellen, and we were just playing jacks. And Norman watches me, and I'm explaining how to play jacks with her. And I guess I was doing it in a funny way or something. And Norman says to my dad, "Boy, your son, he's really funny." And my dad says, "What? That kid? No, he's not funny. He's too dour. You know, he's too dour. He's not funny." Anyway, he was the first. Norman was the first guy to recognize that I could make somebody laugh. And
that's
I was
awesome.
Like eight. Yeah,
that's awesome. Well, I mean, and despite your longtime friendship and knowing his family, what was Norman like on the set at that time? I know, and I've read that he really was a guy that not only pushed the boundaries of what the content was, but he pushed the cast to do their very best. Yeah,
he did. He did. I mean, that was one of the great abilities he had, which is he would push people way beyond their comfort zone. And so, and he also encouraged everybody to participate and create. So it was strange because we used to have a run through on Wednesday because we did it in front of a live audience on Friday, and we'd have a run through just for the producers and the director and the writers. And one week we had Herb Gardner came up to visit, and Herb Gardner is a great playwright, and you'd done A Thousand Clowns and some great plays that had been on Broadway. And in Broadway, you know, you can't change anything. You have to get the playwright's permission to change a word, you know. And after the run-through, we're all sitting around, and Norman and all of us, and we're all just throwing out ideas and saying, "Well, no, why don't you take that line, and let me have this," and everybody is, like, pitching in.
Wow.
And Herb looks at it and he says, "Well, this is like creative communism. I've never seen anything like this."
Yeah, yeah.
You know, everybody, and that was Norman. He set a tone that said, "I want this to be as good as it can be, and I'm going to push everybody as hard as I can to get it to where it was." Yeah, and I think that's what made it great.
And that's not normal. I mean, you know, most creative people want to have full creative control of what they're doing, and to create that team environment and to work together. I mean, that probably created a really great experience on the set.
It did. And I can tell you about one time, because we used to do a show in front of a 5 o'clock, 5:30 show, and then we do it again at 8 o'clock.
Right.
Two different audiences.
Mm-hmm.
So we get two shots at doing the show. And one week, and I'll never forget it, the first act of the show just laid there. I mean, it was terrible. It didn't get any laughs.
Mm-hmm.
Second act was strong. And so we did, you know, now we're between shows and we're trying to think, what are we going to do? So we started improvising. The four of us just started improvising back and forth. And they started writing it down. And we went out literally like 2 hours later and just did what we had come up with that night.
Wow.
And it worked.
Wow.
And that's only because we had a team that was really, really, well-oiled. And also people who knew how to work with each other. That was, again, Norman set that tone.
Yeah, I was going to say, and looking out for each other. Absolutely. No question.
Yeah, yeah.
Tell us a little bit about working with Carol O'Connor.
Well, Carol was amazing. I mean, you know, people always say, you know, I played the liberal, you know, and Carol played the conservative. The truth of the matter is he was way more liberal than I was.
Wow.
I mean, he was way, way to the left. And I was more in the middle, you know, kind of more moderate. But he was great to work with because he did teach me about acting and how to make a moment work and how not to push something when you didn't have to. And he was a great contributor, you know, just to each script, as we all were. And so I love working with him. I you know, he was what a great act. I mean, everybody, Gene, Sally, they all were great to work with. And, you know, I miss Carol. I miss Gene. Sally's still around. But, you know, it was like a family. And I could tell you, you know, when people who've done shows, I mean, they do 22 now. We did, you know, 24, 26 shows every year.
Yeah.
And you spend more time with your TV family than you do with your home family. And by the end of it, you really do become close. And so when we did that last show where we said goodbye and we were leaving to go, you know, I guess to go up to the West Coast, there was no acting there. I mean, that was just, I was crying and I was like, you know, it was like over. And
long time to be together.
Absolutely. Yeah, it was amazing. Plus, you know, what was going on in the world at the time. We had, like I said, the Vietnam War was going on. We had, you know, racial tension. You know, not that much different, oddly enough.
It isn't.
We have a war going on now, but not, you know, we do have in Afghanistan and Iraq, but not like that. And we still have racial tensions. But we had all that going on, and we were allowed to talk about that stuff every week.
Oh, my God.
You know, about it on the show every week.
Racism, anti-Semitism, infidelity, you know, transgender, women's liberation, rape, religion, miscarriages, abortion, menopause, cancer. I mean, do you even see the show? Could it ever be made today?
Well, I think it would be, you know, I think it would, for in a prime time kind of situation, I don't think it could be because we're living into, you know, into PC a world, you know. I think, you know, maybe if it's on late at night or some kind of, you know, cable thing or whatever, maybe. But, I mean, it certainly seems like, I mean, the country couldn't be more divided than it is right now. Mm-hmm. I mean, to be able to do a red state, blue state show, it would seem to me it would work.
Yeah,
if you could figure out a way to do it.
You know, the central character, Archie, abrasive, bigoted, a little bit ignorant, but he related to audiences. And I think part of that was he loved his wife, he loved his daughter.
Exactly.
And I think at the back end, he loved his son-in-law, too.
He did.
Yeah.
He did. And that's the difference between, you know, people who, when you think of somebody who's bigoted like that, you think, well, that they're not human. And the truth is, they are human. And they, you know, it's like you watch The Godfather, and you say, oh, he's a criminal, you know, but he loved his family, you know. Mm-hmm. And that's what makes him human. And we had a lot of criticism when the first show first came on the air. Laura Hobson, who wrote Gentleman's Agreement, said, there's no such thing as a lovable bigot, you know, you can't have that. And we showed that you can. I mean, he did care about his wife, he did love his daughter, he did ultimately love his son-in-law. And, you know, that makes the character more interesting.
We're talking to entertainment legend Rob Reiner, and there's more after this on 720 WGN.